Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the EG Property Podcast with me, EG editor Sam McClary. The following podcast was recorded as part of EG's Future of UK Cities event, so if you'd prefer to watch it rather than just hear, then please do head over to egi.co.uk/thefutureofukcities, where you can engage with all of the content from the 3-day event. If you are staying with me to just listen, then get ready for an aural treat. As in this podcast, former Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Hammond, gives us a fascinating and sometimes brutally honest view of the UK economy and its prospects. Expect phrases like no silver bullet, structural change is inevitable, trauma, change, big shocks and skinny deals. And really, so much more, including what he'd be doing if he was Chancellor today. And spoiler alert, he says he'd certainly be less popular than the current Chancellor. It's a great listen, but I would say that, wouldn't I? So why don't you find out for yourselves right now?
Philip, welcome, and thank you for joining us, and over to you.
Thank you, Sam, and it's a great pleasure to be here this morning and to be able to close this conference. I'm here among you enjoying very much a re-engagement as a participant in the commercial world after 10 years in ministerial office. I've been working with Oak North Bank since the beginning of the year, and I watched Oak North become the UK's largest fintech during my period of office as Chancellor, and I'm delighted to be working with them, engaged with their programme of support for British business and particularly for the real estate sector as it battles with the challenges of COVID and prepares to take the opportunities that will present as we come out of this crisis in due course. I should say that as I reflect on the state of the UK economy and the challenges that lie ahead today, the views that I'm expressing are my own and not the corporate views of Oak North Bank. As we look at the British economic picture today, of course, it is dominated by the challenge of COVID. The government's response to the first wave of the pandemic earlier this year was a classic fiscal stimulus response. That response was only possible because of the hard work and sheer determination of the British people over a long period after 2010 in rebuilding our public finances. As we reduced our deficit from almost 10% of GDP down to just 1.2% when I left office, we had been telling people that this fiscal consolidation was not some theoretical construct. We were doing it for a reason. And the reason was to ensure that the British economy and the British public finances would be resilient to the next shock that came along. No one, I think, envisaged that that shock would take the form that it did of a global pandemic. But I hope the people who had to bear the burden of that fiscal adjustment over the last decade now understand why it was so important that we did that in order to be able to have the firepower to support jobs and businesses through the short-term challenges of the COVID epidemic. And that's exactly what the government has done. But in the long term, structural change will be unavoidable, and the government cannot protect the public, businesses, workers against that structural change. And frankly, it should not try. In the short term, we protect jobs and businesses against what has been a liquidity crisis. But in the longer term, we have to protect people, not individual jobs and businesses. We have to retrain and reskill the resources that will be released by businesses which fail and jobs which are made redundant so that they can take their place in the recovery that will come, hopefully, in the spring of 2021 as we start to move forward. And the lessons of Britain's economic history are very clear, that it is a mistake to try to resist the need for structural change. We did it in the 1970s. We've done it again in subsequent recessions, and it only means that the pain of the adjustment is greater and the resumption of economic growth takes longer. The trajectory of our recovery from the position we're in today as a result of the COVID shock obviously depends significantly on the development of a vaccine or a treatment for the disease. But I think the most sensible working assumption today is that there will not be a silver bullet. There may well be a vaccine, there may well be an effective treatment, but it is unlikely to be a complete solution. So I think the planning scenario against which we have to operate is a gradual return to a new normal of economic activity. And new normal will be different from old normal. This crisis has accelerated a number of significant trends that were already apparent in our economy. The decline of high street retail and the move online for much of our shopping. The evolution of a cashless society, which has taken a huge step forward during the crisis. And the trend to working more flexibly, including working from home. On top of that, of course, we've seen some huge sector-specific impacts in the hospitality sector, in leisure, in travel, in aviation, but other smaller, more specific sectors across the economy have been affected disproportionately. And as with any recession, there will be a shakeout of overextended businesses and people operating with weak business models across the whole range of the economy. Real estate will be in the front line of change. The long lease structure means that the impact of that change may be delayed in its full effect. But as we see retail continue to decline, as we see the demand for office space changing, perhaps in total quantum, certainly in terms of pattern of that demand, we will see the real estate industry being faced with some very significant challenges and very significant structural change over the years and decades ahead. And perhaps in the residential sector as well, if in fact working from home becomes part of the new normal and people's concept of what they need as a home becomes different in consequence. And by the way, probably a very interesting discussion to be had with the tax man about what will and will not be allowable in terms of employer support for employees working from their own home in terms of provision of infrastructure, heating, and the rest of it. Huge implications too of the COVID crisis and its after effects for public policy. On infrastructure investment, if people are going to work from home for part of the week and commuting into our cities becomes a part-time activity, many of the big transport infrastructure projects that we thought were our top priority just a few weeks or months ago may no longer seem as necessary as they once did. And big implications for the public finances. The Chancellor at the moment is the most popular member of the government, but that may not last. His largesse will have to be unwound. The question is when and how, and I'm going to return to that question later on in my remarks. But COVID isn't the only source of uncertainty facing our economy. Markets and businesses are facing at least two other big uncertainties today: the US election and the prospect of the end of the Brexit transition period at the end of this year. The outcome of the US election will be significant for global trade, and global trade is hugely important to Britain's economy. Our relations with China are crucially dependent on the state of relations between China and the US. Is the US really engaging to deal with unacceptable Chinese trade practices, or is it in fact operating a policy of strategic containment, seeking to prevent China's economy developing in order to prevent China developing as a military and strategic power. Would a Joe Biden White House behave any differently to a Trump White House? I'm sure the language and the tone would be very different, but would the substance be any different? I'm not so sure. And how would the Chinese respond to continued pressure from the US administration on patterns of trade? And what are the implications for the United Kingdom? My fear is that China may be pushed into building a trade bloc of its own, and that that trade bloc may become an exclusive bloc, which makes it more difficult for British businesses in the post-Brexit period to penetrate the vitally important and high-growth Asian markets. The second big uncertainty beyond COVID that we're all facing is Brexit. That's been a major uncertainty around the UK economy since 2016. And it's not clear yet whether the drop in business confidence after the referendum in 2016 was due to uncertainty, not being sure what the long-term outcome would be, or certainty, being sure that the outcome would be negative. We're going to find out by the end of this year, of course, when at least the uncertainty will end and we will know for sure what the UK's future relationship with the European Union looks like. This is a UK-specific risk, and it will be a differentiator in the COVID recovery. As other countries recover from COVID, the UK will be doing so while also coping with a second shock of leaving the single market, effectively at the end of the transition period. And we should be in no doubt that whether we get a deal or not, there will be a shock to the UK economy at the end of the year. The facts are simple. Over 40% of our exports go to the European Union. A huge part of the value added in the UK economy is generated in supply chains that crisscross the border between the UK and the European Union. Whether there is no deal or a, as it's known, skinny deal at the last minute, there will be a shock. The difference between no deal and a light touch deal will be whether we have tariffs or not on our manufactured goods, and perhaps more importantly, in the mood music between the UK and the European Union. If we do have a deal, however light touch, I think the mood will lighten and it's possible that we'll be able to build on it in the future. If there is no deal, relations are likely to go into the deep freeze. So a deal is infinitely better, but both will be a big shock. There will be friction at the borders, deal or no deal. There will be impact on our ability to trade our services into the European Union, deal or no deal. There will be a challenge for British manufacturing business around the rules of origin that define how much value of imported content there can be in goods which qualify as British when we export them, whether to the European Union or beyond. It's very important for British business to understand that even a deal is not a continuation of the status quo. So the UK faces some immediate challenges, COVID and Brexit in particular. In my view, both the impact of the COVID pandemic and our exit from the single market will make the UK poorer in the long term, but they will not be the determinants of the UK's economic future. Because before Brexit, before COVID, the UK faced some real challenges and enjoyed some real advantages. On the positive side, the resilience, the diversity, and the scale of the UK economy are great protectors. We are no longer the world's fifth largest economy, but we are comfortably in the top 10 and will expect to remain there for some time to come. We have some unfair advantages, drives the French mad, our language, our time zone, our legal system. We have institutions which are tried and tested and trusted around the world, although as we challenge those institutions, we should remember that reputations are hard won and easily lost. Our universities and the IP that's developed in our technology institutions are a great advantage for the United Kingdom, and we're gradually improving our ability to apply that technology in the UK rather than simply exporting it abroad, as we have done for most of my lifetime. We're a major player, the world's second largest exporter of services, at a time when the demand for sophisticated services in emerging market economies is growing exponentially. And we have a people with huge entrepreneurial flair. On the negative side, we have to navigate demographics as we move into a period when the UK's dependency ratio, the proportion of retired people to working people in the population, will start to grow very rapidly, with a huge impact on our public finances beginning right now in the early 2020s. And our old friend, the productivity gap, with the UK way behind our international competitors on productivity. That's about raising our performance on skills, and specifically on technical skills. It's about closing the north-south divide, which has such a scarring effect on the productivity performance of the British economy. It's about ensuring that our cities are powerhouses of economic growth, as they are across Europe, but not in the UK, where only two of our cities outside London, Bristol and Aberdeen, have higher productivity performance figures than the economy as a whole. And it's about addressing decades of underinvestment, both in our public infrastructure and in private capital in our businesses and industries. And of course, as we move forward, we face the challenge of decarbonisation, a £2 trillion investment in our economy over the next 30 years. And of course, the decarbonisation investment that we'll be making will create jobs and create huge opportunities for businesses. But this investment will be investment to substitute the type of energy that we consume rather than to add to our consumption. It will be qualitative, not quantitative. And I'm afraid for many of our citizens, it will feel like a further period of austerity as we direct investment not into expanding consumption, but into changing the composition of consumption from hydrocarbons-based energy to green energy over the next 30 years. And we'll also have to deal with the dramatic effects, the challenges and the opportunities of the fourth industrial revolution, a period of technological change unprecedented in our history, which is going to be hugely disruptive and hugely exhilarating for those who are able to seize the opportunities it presents, changing our patterns of work and life, the way we do business, the way we do politics, the way we do everything, probably far more than COVID has done. It will have big impacts on the pattern of global trade as we see reshoring becoming a genuine possibility as the benefits of economies of scale and the significance of cheap labour decline as production processes are fully automated. A return to localism as economies of scale disappear. The age of mass production perhaps coming to an end and a new bespoke economy where even people on modest incomes can afford to have things designed and made to their specific requirements by computer-driven, fully automated production systems. But change will be traumatic. There will be huge churn, many jobs lost as new jobs are created, old skills redundant and new skills required, huge disruption and a need to carry a skeptical population with us. Driverless vehicles may be a very exciting prospect for you and I, but if you earn your living as a truck driver or a van driver or a taxi driver, this will look like a threat and nothing but a threat to your future. And I fear that we will have to fight a wave of protectionism in public opinion, fueled by fear of the change that the fourth industrial revolution will bring. And I want to conclude just by making a few comments about the state of the public finances and what we can expect to see over the coming years. This is a populist government, and giving money away is generally more popular than taking it back. But the government will have to halt and eventually reverse the crisis spending that we've seen over the last 8 months. And it will probably have to trim its pre-crisis ambitions set out before the onset of the COVID pandemic. Of course, the government should focus on investment rather than consumption in order to raise productivity, generate higher wages, and ensure rising living standards. But that may not be the same, it may not be the same infrastructure investment as we thought it would be in February, as the COVID recession has changed the pattern of activity in our economy, made us more reliant on our broadband infrastructure, perhaps less reliant on our commuter rail infrastructure. So on tax, I would expect that we will see some high-profile tax increases on unpopular groups of the population: companies, foreigners, rich people, changes to capital gains tax, some modest increases to corporation tax, some significant changes to the rules around pension contributions, and definitely some taxes on anybody who looks as though they may have made a windfall out of the COVID crisis. But there are, in my view, unlikely to be broad-based tax rises, which are the only type of tax rises that raise any serious money, until after the next general election, because populist governments do not generally like to tell ordinary people that they are going to have to pay more to contribute to paying off the debts that have been run up during the crisis we've just been through. So borrowing will take the strain, at least for the next few years. Meanwhile, there's been a massive expansion of money supply globally, as there was in 2009, 2010. And most of that will go into inflation of asset prices rather than wage price inflation. And of course, it will go into funding government deficits. Rising asset prices only widens the gaps that were already dangerously large and have been further emphasized by COVID, presenting yet another set of challenges for UK politicians. In the short term, UK inflation risks are from the real economy through post-Brexit frictions, higher costs of imported goods as we see frictions at the borders, and potentially higher costs as we see sterling depreciate in response to the changed UK terms of trade. In the longer term, population demographics and the impact of technology on employment, I believe, make deflation a much bigger risk than inflation. The population forecasts are really quite scary. Asset values may inflate further in the short term, but as populations fall and economies start to shrink across the globe, over the long term, real asset prices, demand for which is linked to population and economic activity, must surely begin to fall. Working out how to prosper in a deflationary world of falling asset prices may well be the key to commercial success over the next 50 years or so. It sounds like a simple challenge, but those of us who are old enough to remember the trauma of the 1970s as we shifted from a period of relatively stable prices to what then became the inflationary norm of the last three or four decades will recall how many people were caught out by that shift. Perhaps we should study a bit more carefully what is going on in Japan and see what lessons we can learn from it. To conclude then, the UK economy must navigate over the next few months further short-term uncertainty around COVID and Brexit, and then it must move decisively to make the necessary structural adjustments once the shape of the new normal is apparent. Longer term, it's the same productivity challenge we've been wrestling with for decades, the aging population that we've long been predicting, but for which, at least in terms of the public finances, I'm afraid we are spectacularly unprepared, and the new and urgent £2 trillion challenge of decarbonisation. These will be the big drivers of the UK economy over the next 20, 30 years. One thing I can predict with some certainty is that life for my successors as chancellors over the next few decades is unlikely to be dull. Thank you. And now, Sam, if I can hand back to you, perhaps we can do some Q&A.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Philip. What a fascinating and really honest speech. And I know if we were in real life, if you remember those days, there would be a round of applause right now. And I know a lot of hands that would go up in the air to ask questions. And I know that because I have many of them in front of me from readers who have sent them in. You have, of course, answered some of them through your speech. You've told us what a no deal or a skinny deal might mean for the UK economy. And you've given us some of your insight on what might happen in terms of tax rises going forward. So I'm gonna jump into question number two, if I may, which is about austerity, which was something that you as Chancellor hope to see the back of. That doesn't look very likely now in that we've got more than £2 trillion of debt. How do you think we will see a route out of austerity, or I suppose if we will?
Well, as I've said, I think borrowing is going to take the strain for the next few years. I mean, it's perfectly sensible for borrowing to continue to take the strain while we remain in a period of depressed demand and depressed output. But even beyond that, for political rather than economic reasons, I would expect the emphasis to be on using borrowing to bridge the gap. But in the end, the costs of the recession will have to be paid for, and there will be some ongoing costs as well. For example, it seems likely that our public transport network will need much higher levels of taxpayer support in the future, because user contributions are likely to be lower as people use the system less. But in the long run, there is only one real answer to this question. We have to raise our game. We have to become more productive as an economy in order to raise wages, raise living standards, and raise the tax contribution. Nobody wants to pay higher taxes as a percentage of their income. By far the better solution is to see fast rising incomes, so that with a stable tax regime, the exchequer can be taking larger receipts to fund the various challenges that the public finances will have to meet over the next few decades.
Fantastic. And you said in your speech that one of the ways that we close that productivity gap is fixing this north-south divide that we see, sadly. And you know we have heard from government that we've talked around levelling up and building our way out of a recession. How do you see that working? How do we close that gap? And is levelling up, particularly with the recent row between Mayor Andy Burnham and central government, how do you see that working?
Well, first of all, I think one of the lessons that we will draw from the COVID pandemic, when the post-mortem is eventually done, and we look across the world at how it's been handled in different places, I think unavoidably will be that highly centralized systems like ours have performed less well than more devolved systems like, for example, Germany or even the United States, where, frankly, the policies of the federal government may not be judged to have been a huge success, but many individual states have used the powers that they have to get much better outcomes locally. So I would expect that we're going to see a strong pressure for more devolution of power within the UK, so that decisions that affect local areas are made far more at local levels, particularly in the big urban conurbations. But on the wider question of closing the north-south gap, this isn't just something that matters to people in the north. It should matter to people across the whole of the UK, because it's about the UK's performance as an economy. And we need to see the great conurbation of the north, if you like, the great urban area represented by Manchester, Liverpool, Leeds, Bradford, right the way across to Hull, these great urban areas, the urban conurbation of the West Midlands. We need to see them operating more as single economic geographies, gaining the benefits of agglomeration, as economists would call it, raising their productivity performance by becoming single markets for labour, goods and services in a way that they simply aren't at the moment, because largely because transport infrastructure isn't there. So it is about improving interconnectivity between the smaller cities and the big regional hubs in the north and the Midlands. But it's not only about infrastructure, it's also about skills. It's about revitalizing the private sector in areas where the public sector is far too dominant in the economy. And it's about rekindling entrepreneurialism where that is missing.
Excellent, thank you. I couldn't agree more. We now have a question, our first question from one of our viewer day. Nigel Buxton from Deutsche Pfandbrief Bank would like to ask you, to what extent do you agree that it is impossible for British cities to be completely discretionary from the wider global economy, particularly focusing on COVID and Brexit as broad catalysts for change?
Well, I'm not quite sure what he means by completely discretionary, but I mean clearly no city can operate in a bubble, especially a city in the UK. The UK is of the large economies in the larger economies in the world, the top 10, top 20. The UK is the one that is generally considered to be most open, most exposed to global trade. And it would be a disaster for the UK if global trade were to decline or even to grow more slowly than we've been used to seeing it growing. Global trade has been a big driver of UK economic growth over the last 20, 30 years. And we certainly need to see it continue. So while I do understand the instinct to pull up the drawbridge sometimes, people just have to resist that instinct, because it is not in the best economic interest of the citizens of this country that we try and cut ourselves up off in some kind of autarkic structure separate from the rest of the world, hidden behind protectionist walls. That is not going to be the route to prosperity for Britain in the future. We have world-leading industries, world-leading services, world-leading technologies, world-leading universities, and we need to be open to the rest of the world and confident in going out there and selling our wares and our services and our capabilities to the rest of the world.
Thank you. And sort of touching on the pulling up the drawbridge, and you have talked a little bit around infrastructure. Another question that's come in is about how, if we are moving from an era of low interest rates or even negative interest rates, does that make the case for serious infrastructure investment, or do the debts incurred in funding furlough, etc., mean that it's more likely that we rein back on that potential investment, or as you've said, put that investment elsewhere?
Yeah, I think the case for infrastructure investment in the UK is unanswerable. Our infrastructure is underdeveloped by comparison with many of our closest competitors, certainly in the European Union. It isn't always the case that you have to have first-class public infrastructure in order to have a successful economy. Look at the US, look at New York City. You'd hardly describe New York City as an example of shining new public infrastructure, and yet it's one of the economic powerhouses of the global economy. But what we see across Europe is that there is a clear correlation between the level of infrastructure investment and the performance of economies. But where we invest that money, I think, is going to change as we move through the fourth industrial revolution, and perhaps as the changes that come as a consequence of the COVID experience change the way we live and work. Some of the investments that might have seemed like priorities a few months ago may no longer be the top priorities in the coming years. But we will have to invest, and this may not be a welcome message, but the economic logic is that we should focus our investment as much as we can. We should focus as much as we can public spending on investment rather than consumption, because investment produces an enduring benefit in terms of additional consumption that can be enjoyed. If we consume the grain rather than planting the seeds, we won't get that long-term benefit.
Thank you, fantastic. So my next few questions are based around discussions that I find myself having very often these days with property owners. There is a little bit of ill feeling, I suppose, towards government at the moment around how it is treating the real estate community. So government has provided a huge amount of support to businesses, to tenants during the pandemic, but has offered very little to the real estate sector, expecting it to have a bottomless supply of blank checks to write. However, we know that real estate is a huge contributor to the national economy. I think in 2018 contributed £100 billion pounds to the national economy. It provides a lot of jobs and holds the key to growth. Do you think that government should be doing more for real estate owners?
Well, I think when we look at the real estate sector, we have to distinguish between the situation faced by the owners of investment property and the situation faced by developers, contractors, and I think the government has been trying to ensure that the development sector, the construction sector, is able to continue to function, and certainly within the banking sector, I know from my work with Oak North, there's been a lot of focus on trying to ensure that short-term challenges don't derail projects which make long-term sense. But government does have to prioritise to some extent, and it's quite difficult for government to use public funds to support an asset-backed sector where the driving force is the asset base rather than employment. And I think the sector will have some big structural changes to face. We're already seeing it. We were already seeing it before the COVID crisis. I drive regularly past a site where two retail parks have been demolished and are being rebuilt as residential developments. And across the economy, we will see real estate being repurposed. And of course, that's much easier in some areas than it is in others. And I think the government, both through the regulatory system, the planning system, and maybe through the fiscal system, can support the real estate industry as it in turn seeks to be supportive of the real economy as it has to change shape in response to the changed structure of the economy. So, for example, as we move perhaps further away from retail to other uses on our high street, real estate owners will need to respond to that demand. And I would expect government will engage with the real estate sector in seeing how it can support that transition.
Would you have any advice for the real estate community in how they have that conversation with government to make sure that there is true understanding and listening and hearing, I suppose?
Well, I think it's a very good question, because I think real estate has something of an image problem. Somehow real estate doesn't rank in the public perception alongside manufacturing or agriculture. And yet it is, as you've pointed out, a vitally important part of the economy. And traditionally, the real estate sector, construction in particular, has played a vital role in supporting the economy in the recovery phase immediately after a recession. But my generic advice, which I always give to all business sectors when they say, how best do we approach government, is this: do it as an industry. Because it is very difficult actually for government to engage with individual players, however large they are. It is much easier and more comfortable for government, for civil servants, to deal with representative industry bodies. Now, the truth is that although every industry has its industry representative bodies, in every industry, and real estate is no different, people are also quite reticent to be completely open in front of their competitors and peers in the industry bodies. And there's an issue to be resolved there. But unless industries and sectors can present to government coherent, broad-based views that do reflect an agreed position across an industry, it's very difficult for government to respond. And let me give away a state secret for nothing, and I won't be sector specific, but I can tell you, as a former chancellor, that it was a routine experience to have an industry representative group coming in to see me from any industry, often with chairman or chief execs of some of the largest businesses in that sector, presenting an industry agreed position at the table to the chancellor, and then to get messages or calls from two or three of those very senior participants from very large and dominant players in that sector over the next few days, saying, actually, we don't entirely agree with the sector position that we presented to you in that meeting, and we just want to let you know what our view is. When government gets conflicting messages from an industry group, it becomes quite difficult to formulate a policy response, and actually quite easy, if you've got lots of other challenges on your agenda, just to put the issues of that sector to one side. So do make compromises in order to have a single clear position. And do, if you're one of the big players, do not go behind the back of the agreed industry-wide consensus to try and put your company-specific points to government.
That is gold dust of advice, Philip. Thank you for that. And music to my ears, because as over the last 3 days of this event, we've been talking very much around the power of collaboration. If people can get a single message and tell it well, it can have such great impact. So thank you very much for that. Now, I know we haven't got a huge amount of time left, and I've got a few more questions. One of them, you've already said that we'll have to halt and reverse the crisis spending at some point, but one of our questions was, should we stop doing that now? And has the support that government's been giving to business throughout the pandemic really been helping, or should we just let the inevitable happen? Is ripping the plaster off now better than trying to paper over the cracks, if that's not mixing metaphors too much?
Yeah. Well, the answer is both. Government should continue to support viable businesses and long-term viable jobs where they are threatened by short-term factors. So, for example, if we are confident that air travel will resume, then we should certainly try to keep together the skills, support the businesses and the jobs that will form that industry in the future. But where it becomes clear that an industry can no longer continue at the scale it has previously operated at, that there is going to have to be loss of jobs, that there are going to have to be business failures, then absolutely rip the plaster off. It does not make sense to use taxpayers' money to go on propping up jobs or businesses in the short term if they have no long-term prospect. Far better to release those resources, support the people involved directly, and help them to retrain and reskill for the jobs of the future. And we know from history that the quicker we do that, the quicker the economy will start to grow again, and the quicker we will return to prosperity.
Thank you very much. So three questions remain, and this next one is going to take us back to sustainability, which you talked about in your speech, which I was really happy to hear. It's something we're really passionate about at EG. And this is a question from Chris Hunter-Taylor from Target Executive Search. And they ask, how optimistic are you, given the current global challenges, that the drive towards making all corporate real estate assets towards net zero carbon is an achievable commitment? And what would you like to see to make that more achievable?
Well, it's technically achievable. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think early clarification from government as to how we are going to heat buildings in the future, whether it is going to be through the continued use of a gas network, which eventually moves to hydrogen, or whether it is going to be through the use of techniques like ground source or air source heat pumps rather than a networked energy supply, would be very, very helpful. But look, and I go back to something I said in my closing speech, the challenge is not a technical challenge. The challenge is one of political will. And I don't mean the will of the government. The government and all political parties are clearly committed to the energy transition and decarbonizing our economy. But we live in a democracy, so we've got to take the people with us. And depending on how fast our economy is growing, it's possible to envisage periods over the next 30 years when making the level of investment needed to get to net zero by 2050 will involve foregoing other investment, which might feel important to the public. New hospitals, new schools, more roads, whatever it is, may have to be foregone because of the commitment we're making to invest what the Treasury has estimated will be around £2 trillion. So what is that, 60 billion, 60 or so billion pounds a year for the next 30 years in the energy transition. And maintaining public support for that investment program is going to be crucial to enabling it to happen.
Thank you. But it is absolutely crucial that it does happen, isn't it? So penultimate question, and one that is something that plays on the mind, I believe, of a lot of our audience, a lot of the real estate audience, which is what the impact of the working from home phenomenon is going to have on offices, on the offices footprint. And just keen to get an idea from you as to how you think that might influence the government's office footprint, and in particular, whether we should look at cancelling the plans to find a new base for the Commons and Lords while Parliament's being refurbed, and if we can run the government from people's homes.
Well, actually, the experiment with running Parliament as opposed to the government from home has not been wholly satisfactory, I think most people would agree. Politics is by nature a communal activity, and working from home, I don't think has enhanced the way our democracy has been working. And I think many people feel that the government hasn't been able to be properly held to account by a parliament that's operating on a dispersed basis. But as far as government is concerned, the government's just like any other office occupier, and I have no doubt that the pattern of its demand will change as a result of the COVID crisis. My personal view is that we will not go back to previous patterns of working, that people who routinely commute to an office will continue to do so, but not on a 5 days a week basis. I suspect that will become the exception rather than the rule. So there may be an impact on the total demand for office space. Obviously, that the way that is felt will be dampened by the structure of commercial property leases in the UK, and it will have a much quicker effect in some other markets where office space is typically occupied on short-term arrangements. But change there will be. And it won't all be in one direction. It may be that as well as there being an overall impact on the aggregate amount of commercial office space required, there may be a significant shift in the pattern of demand for office space. It might be the case, for example, that companies seek to locate offices close to population centres outside of the big cities, where people can commute by car if they don't feel safe or confident in the use of public transport. I think it's too early for us to know yet, because a lot of this will depend on the extent to which there is a vaccine or a treatment for COVID, which makes people feel less threatened by the use of mass transit public transport systems. And I think that's going to be the big key to the future of city centre office space.
Thank you. And our final question for today, which I think is a brilliant question for any former or ex-something. And so thanks to Tom Elliott of InMedia for this question. You know what's coming. If you were still Chancellor today, what would you be doing?
Look, I don't think, if I was Chancellor today, I probably wouldn't be as popular as the current Chancellor is because of the positions that I have taken and am known to have taken on other issues, nothing to do with COVID. But I would certainly be bracing myself for a much more difficult next 6 months in terms of the experience as Chancellor than the last 6 months. The Chancellor spent the last 6 months giving money away. That's generally easier than taking it back. And he knows that he's going to have to curtail the largesse of government and then start to recover some of the cost of this crisis over the coming years. And that's going to be a much more difficult challenge. And at the same time, he's got to focus people's minds back on those long-term challenges about raising Britain's productivity, about the public finance implications of dealing with an ageing population, about financing the decarbonisation agenda, and about readying the country for the impact of the fourth industrial revolution. So he knows that he's got a huge agenda ahead of him, and it will be very, very challenging to deliver all of those things against the backdrop of the perhaps slow and difficult recovery from the COVID pandemic.
Philip, thank you ever so much for your intelligence and insight today. It's been fascinating talking to you. I could keep listing through questions as there are so many, but thank you for joining us. Thank you for closing out this this wonderful conference, and thank you for really sharing a really honest view of what the world is looking like. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the EG Property Podcast. We hope you found the content insightful and helpful. If you'd like more of the same and to keep up with all the latest news, views, analysis and research that the EG Group has to provide, be sure to sign up to all of our property podcasts and subscribe to Radius Data Exchange for unlimited access to all of our content and comprehensive commercial real estate data.